I was thinking of where to begin, and therefore indeed where to end. But where to begin, I was thinking the amount of work you've done, the amount of CDs you've released, does it start to become, do you get a sense of the shape of it behind you and where you've been? Or in a way, is the important thing to keep moving on and not be too intimidated by it?
Yeah, I honestly think it's the latter in my case. I really don't think a great deal about, you know, what's happened in the past. And it is very much a forward-looking game. I mean, you're always thinking, right, well, I'm really onto something now. I think, you know, I'll soon have it together. Yes. It always has been like that, I think, for me. And I think I'm not alone in that. There are other musicians. I often quote, I was very lucky enough to do an interview with Sonny Rollins for the BBC. And he, of course, says, well, I never listened to my old recordings. And I said, well, you know, funnily enough, I'm exactly the same. I listen to them and sometimes I can admire what other people were playing on them. But usually I'm thinking, yes, it's okay, but I could, you know, I could do better, or I remember that bit. Yeah, I didn't like that so much. So it's, you know, once critical faculties come in listening to them. And I think, you know, I think as long as I'm always looking for something else, I kind of know that, it's all, for me, all's well in the world, because I think that's the way it should be. And but I think we both agreed, Rollins and I, that perhaps sometimes we'd both do well to look back. We might learn something from looking at what's in the past. So it's not something that one never does, but I don't really think a great deal about it.
I was wondering if it can be a situation where you might listen to one of the older albums and almost reach a stage where you can listen to it as if it was done by someone else and therefore have a perspective on it that would be a great help, or whether you would always remember the circumstances it was made, how it was made, why it was made, and therefore it wouldn't be useful in that way. Or almost that you could become, if you like, astonished by what you've done and think, God, did I really do that when I was 25 or 30 or whatever?
Well, the moment that the track starts, I remember it all.
Yeah.
It just comes back to me for better or for worse. But sometimes, I must admit, you know, I can be caught by surprise. Something will be on the radio and Karen will call, oh, look, this is one of your things. And I'll say, well, that's pretty good, actually. You know, so it's not that I certainly don't dismiss all the work that's happened in the past. Far from it. I mean, I understand, its importance. And without all that behind me, I wouldn't be where I am today, because that is the very experience upon which you build, really.
Yes. When I look back at your career, and this may just be hindsight, it may just be that you kind of build in a narrative into something that actually happened quite randomly, but there does seem certain things that happened in the right way, in the right order, from the way back, you being a choir boy, you know, getting your first saxophone, the way that happened, and then finding yourself in the position in the 60s with so much happening, with those kind of amazing jazz figures that were in this country that were kind of connected but yet not quite connected with rock, and then the way it moves forward into the 70s and working in Paris and then to ECM, it all seems like, you know, looking back, it seemed one thing led to the other and you were in the right position at the right time because of it. But I guess at the time it was all fairly, you know, well, improvised, I guess, wasn't it?
Well, again, you're so right. I mean, I think looking back, you know, one can see, you know, it's quite easy. Well, I won't say quite easy, but you find a pattern. You see a pattern. It looks as if a pattern has been evolving. But in point of fact, I think, you know, I think I've always been doing what has to be done next. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I haven't been driven towards doing things that I've always wanted to do. And I think it is certainly true to say that the music that I grew up with, which, as I've often said, wasn't actually jazz music till I was 15 or something, that's to say classical music and you know, popular song of the day, that stuff, that's, you know, I've all kind of felt that I've been working towards finding a way of making that a part of the music that I grew to love, which was jazz. So finding ways of using string players and sort of classical type ensembles or folk music or whatever in ways that, you know, allow me to do this kind of improvising thing that I love to do. So, you know, perhaps I have been working towards that. But you know, when you're doing it at the time, it years pass before things evolve into what you want them to be. And sometimes they turn into something that you didn't expect, which can be equally rewarding. Mm.
And do you think it was important that you had that background before you started to like jazz, that you'd already got some musical instincts and some musical loves that weren't jazz and weren't traditionally jazz, coming from where jazz was, so that when you took jazz, it could become immediately something purely personal?
Well, I suppose it was important to me, but I mean, if you look at, you know, look at other figures in the music, I mean, some have certainly not done that, and they've been tremendously exciting and fantastically jazzy and really vital figures, people that haven't had that, but that's the way it was for me. And so, you know, that's, you know, in a way, that's what, you know, and I've let, in a way, I've partly let that come out, if you like. I've let that evolve within me, and I've partly steered towards it to a certain extent. I think it's more finding as I've gone along that things were possible that have kind of led me from one thing to another, rather than thinking my goal in life is to form a kind of an ensemble which links all these things. It's never really been that. Yeah. It's just been that I've felt like, you know, maybe the fact that I got interested in synthesizers and started to do this kind of semi-composed music with synthesizers led me to think, yeah, you know, I could do this stuff with real instruments as well, and maybe, you know, maybe something in the future for me, if I ever get to it, is to combine the lot, which I've never actually done much of, is to put electronics together with an instrument to make a palette of those things.
Because you tend to do the synthesizer with you. It's like you're finding something to improvise against, so you can be on your own but still improvise.
Yeah.
Now, in the 60s, we had this incredible burst of activity in English jazz. You know, you've got the Evan Parkers and the Derek Baileys and the John Stevens, that you've got you, Stan Tracy, you know, Osborne, Skidmore, Gibbs, Westbrook. Astonishing. The burst into life of English jazz, British jazz. And then in a way, in the 70s and 80s, it sort of kind of fell apart a little bit. There didn't seem to be a continual arrival of similar mentalities, if you like, you know, quite experimental mentalities. Was it something to do with the 60s being very much a sort of avant-garde time and a politically sort of a motivated time that enabled those minds to sort of all appear simultaneously, inspired by what was happening in America?
It's probably, probably kind of twofold development there in a way, because up to a point, when it got to the end of the 60s, the if you like, the trunk of the tree of jazz kind of stopped, really. And at the end of the avant-garde, there was fusion and confusion. in a way that line of that we had from Louis Armstrong to Roy Eldridge to Dizzy to Clifford Brown, to, you know, that suddenly stopped happening. The music had evolved perhaps as far as it could go in a direct line of development. Because after all, I think what you looked at with jazz starting, if we pretend it started in 1900, if you like, so that sort of first 60 years, harmonically, rhythmically, it was becoming more and more sophisticated, taking more of the elements from Western European music and bunging more stuff into this world music mix. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, eventually it reached the same point of harmonic development, and so where freedom became the thing. And we were at, so that music, that jazz had arrived at the same point as Cage and Cornelius Cardew and so on, the freedom thing. So then what happens? And then if you look perhaps even at classical music, you'd say, you know, I'm using classical in the word in that easy way we do when we converse. You know, then, you know, you find, what's happening there? Whoa, that's funny stuff going on there. We've had serial music. And then after that, where does it go? And then, but then so, and I think partly that's what happened in the 70s anyway, that things are going to happen. And then, of course, you have this, you know, when you do have these kind of curious periods when there's a great deal happening, then I suppose it's just common, the cyclical thing of like, well, then suddenly if there aren't all that many people, or they dissipate, that energy dissipates and spreads out, as it were, you know.
And was it kind of like almost a sort of a rocket behind you that sent you out from the 60s and 70s in a way?
Oh yeah, it was a very, very exciting time to be playing music in this country, and I think in fact in Europe generally, because once I'd slipped down through the Dover Calais, entrance and got into Europe, I found all these people over there that were, you know, an awful lot of action going on in Germany and in France and in Scandinavia. In fact, that kind of excitement was over there, was there too.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was a fantastic period. And I think what was great, in what I particularly I enjoyed, was, of course, I mean, here I am, I'm what, early 20s. It's a very much a learning period. I mean, I wasn't an experienced player. I was learning. And to have Chris McGregor coming in from South Africa with that kind of stuff, to have the West Indian community living in Ladbroke Grove with the Calypso things and that kind of rhythmic energy, to have Alexis and that kind of the Blues Incorporated thing and the birth, as it were, of the, what was going to become R&B, the white R&B with all those guys, all of this going on simultaneously, you know, and Mike Gibbs and you know, those guys bringing in this the fusion elements. And
yes.
So it was a fantastic time. I would be going from one thing to another thing in that different genre of music in the same day.
And beginning to make set up a lot of those collaborations, many of which still sort of exist today. But along the way, there's been this remarkable combination of you, sometimes on your own, sometimes duo, trio, small ensemble, big ensemble, a constantly sort of circulation of different minds that you're playing with. And I wondered if, in a way, you know, we call this music jazz a lot of the time, not least because of the instruments you're using and where it originally came, the freedom, etc. But a lot of the time, it's this kind of incredible sort of meeting of individual people on their own journeys and then combining with them to take a little bit from them, you give them something back, and these unbelievable modules keep developing.
Well, isn't it that whole thing about when you're meeting with somebody musically, you're actually meeting with another personality too. It's not just about a particular musical style. And I think perhaps that was the joy of that particular period in the 60s and perhaps early 70s, when suddenly it wasn't necessary to conform to a particular genre to be accepted as a you know, a musician, or to be accepted as something that you wanted to listen to, that as audiences wanted to listen to. They were interested to hear what would this combination come up with, and what was that music? Ears started to open, perhaps, both for audiences and for the musicians.
Yes.
So that suddenly, you know, I mean, for example, if you take a colleague of mine from the late 60s or 70s, Bar Phillips, a bass player from San Francisco. Well, up to a point, he was never a straightforward jazz player. You know, he came from a tradition of really contemporary music, much in the same way, shall we say, as Barry Guy's way of playing. Only Barry had come from America, but with all the Californian things that he had to bring to it. And already there was a different kind of dialogue going on there. And that combination that we had with the trio, which was quite explosive, with Stu coming from Manhattan, very much in the jazz music tradition, and this collision between, you know, me from the West Country with my old Zoider folk songs, and Barr from San Francisco with the Ant stuff, and Stu right in the middle, you know, holding this stuff together. So that was a kind of implosion and explosion,
yes,
if you like.
It is interesting because the whole point in one way of looking at jazz is that it's this call for freedom in a way, and this attempt to sort of transcend limitations. Oddly and paradoxically, that often means being boxed in by being known as jazz. But it seems to be your generation and then later what happened in terms of the label you ended up on, which we'll get to in a minute, it seems to be that you'd found ways to continue that spirit of transcending limitations, so that often it echoed jazz. It was within sight of jazz, but it was something else. You were constantly finding a new place to be.
Well, I think it was, I mean, somehow or other, it's about the liberation of the individual, this music, to me. It's the thing of people having their own voice. And for me, that's been the driving force. And these are the musicians that I've loved to work with. Those who perhaps don't conform strictly to any of the, you know, format. People who are curious about this area of music, who, you know, and have a distinct personality and who play in their own way. And for me, that's what attracted me to jazz. I mean, listening to jazz players from the 50s, and I'm talking primarily now about American players, because the strength we have to, you know, from up until the 50s was there, even though we had great players like Toby Hayes, for example, and so on. You could listen to a tenor player and know immediately who it was because their phrases were different, their tone quality was different, you know, their very personality was different. And that's what attracted me to it. And that was the whole quest, in a way, of my development, was really looking to find my own voice. I think we all felt, we all were aware of that amazing, those stories between Ben Webster and Coleman Hawkins saying, you know, man, you stole my shit, yeah. And, you know, you're just standing playing my stuff. And they're, you know, that they each found their own distinctive voice. And yes. This, you know, at the point of a tenor battle was no good if everyone sounded the same.
Sure.
The point was you had to sound, you had to have your own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the driving force, I think, for me and for the Mike Westbrook and for the people of my generation.
Yeah.
That, you know, you didn't, really, you obviously learned the way to play jazz by listening to other people, but the search was on to find what am I?
Was there a moment where you feel you could say I found it? I've got that thing that's my voice.
Still searching.
You're still, I thought you might
but
say
I
that.
Think, you know, I know, yeah, but I mean, it's glib to say that. And the fact of the matter is, I think I realized that at a certain point, perhaps when I was doing Westering Home, that first solo recording with the looping and stuff, I realized, well, this is a bit odd, but I think we're getting to something that's a bit personal to me.
Because it's the SOS, where you've got Alan Skidmore, Mike Osborne and John Sermon, that's sort of 72, 73, is it, I think?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah, and there's basically three sax. I mean, there I can tell.
Yeah.
It's you, you know, and that's quite early, relatively speaking, isn't it, for you to say you're still searching? I think very definitely you're...
Yeah, I think by that time, an idea that, you know, this weird stuff that I'm thinking about, I think that's probably what I'm into. That's my thing, you know, so, yeah. So, I mean, it's not a case of, no, I didn't think about it, you know.
In the 70s, you seemed to sort of be searching for a label, if you like, a place that could suit how you work, because a lot of this kind of, where jazz became close to rock, it tended to often be placed on rockish kind of labels, didn't it, with rockish kind of routines, if you like. You put an album out and that would be kind of it, very fixed, whereas I guess the idea was a lot of mobility, a lot of musical mobility, and you were on Island, weren't you, Duram, Dawn, and in a way, I guess, the label that you were looking for and has been obviously the label that you were looking for, was ECM, which you got to at the end of the 1970s.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be the best place for you because it allows you to pursue your own direction and constantly come up with unexpected, you know, other people to be with.
Interestingly enough, Manfred was quite interested in me before I got to make the first albums, but it was tied up a little bit contractually with these other old-fashioned three-year sign a contract, do three albums type of deals. So it took a little while to become available. And I think there also something else happened in the 70s, which is probably, which wasn't too obvious to, you know, anybody looking at my career, is that I spent a good deal of it between 73 and 78 in Paris, at Paris Opera, doing music for choreography and for dance. Yeah. Which actually was a fantastic learning experience for me. I mean, it gave me a real opportunity to work with electronics, with synthesizers, at a time when they were huge and complex, and needed quite a, you know, a crew of people to help and, you know, carry them around and everything. And I had that at working with Carlson at the Paris Opera. So actually that was quite an important period when I wasn't recording a great deal, but I was making a lot of music and working in this kind of dance theatre form, which has proved, I think, very useful to me over the years. I learned a great deal from that, working with dance, about the use of space in the music and outside the music, and, you know, and the effect of theatre and so on. So when finally Manfred said to me, well, I think I'd done an album with him, Mick Goodrick and... Jack and Eddie Gomez, and then Manfred said, well, you know, so can we do something? And I said, well, what about solo? And that's how that started, and that it became, and we did Upon Reflection.
Yes.
I think next one was Simon Simon, and then we went back to a few more solo things. And they, a lot of that music evolved, had evolved from the work that I'd done at Paris Opera. So I was kind of workshopping music there, as well as learning a great deal.
The ACM is an extraordinary record label. It's kind of almost a mythical beast in a way. The amount of music it makes, the amount of cross-fertilisation. And you're one of the prime acts on the label. I mean, what has it been like to be at ECM in terms of allowing you to compose and make the music that you want to make? And what is it particularly like collaborating with Manfred Eicher?
Well, you can't separate ECM from Manfred. I mean, Manfred is ECM. I mean, I perhaps nowadays with such a large output, I don't know if he's as, if everything goes past him, but certainly in the first two decades that I worked with him, I mean, virtually everything for artwork, notes, editing, everything passed by his desk. And he was there for recording, for mixing, discussing the cover photograph, and absolutely everything. I mean, Manfred is extremely hands-on. And, you know, so when you ask what it is to be with ECM, it's to be with Manfred, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Manfred's a dream, this label, and he stuck to his guns, and he's had this, you know, he's always recorded stuff, whether it was going to be very successful. If he thought it was worth it, he would do it.
And what would you say is his vision, his aesthetic? What is he trying to achieve? What is he wanting to say? Because he's like an auteur in a way. They're individual statements as much as they are obviously refracted through so many other personalities.
Well, you know, if you ask me what he's trying to say, I'd say you just got to listen to the catalogue, because it's all there, isn't it? I mean, it's a broad scope, but I think certainly in the initial stages, I think what he really wanted to do was, he said, look, when I listen to a jazz quartet or a trio recording, I want to hear every detail. I want to hear the very subtle thing that, you know, he was very fond of the Bill Evans Trio, for example. He, instead of wanting to hear someone laughing at a table in a jazz club, and that famous recording, what is it?
Village Vanguard.
Porgy or something. Village Vanguard one. Yeah, yeah. You know, he wanted to hear the subtle details of Paul Motion's brushwork and this kind of thing. Mm. So I think one of his goals was he said this should be recorded with the same degree of attention and quality of chamber music. And so, you know, if you wanted it as a starting point, I think he maybe began there and said, you know, most of this stuff, the sound is awful and the musicians deserve more than that. And the other thing that I would have said was very, very strong was that he wanted the music really to be created in the studio. Because a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, jazz, it's a live music and you don't get the atmosphere when it's in the studio. Well, I can tell you that the amount of tension in recording, I mean, the stuff was done in 2 days. And he was much happier when we were walking on eggshells with it. He loved the first takes, the ones where we weren't quite sure, but that for him was the true improvisation, the real, really when the guys went back to the wall, what do you do? When he was, I don't think he's ever been that interested in music that comes from the comfort zone. Whatever, really happy.
Yeah.
Play their licks.
Although paradoxically, because of the sound and the you know, the reputation it now has for its sound, there is some suggestion, of course, that it neutralizes, because the sound is so clear and so perfect that oddly enough it almost has the opposite effect, that some of that tension you're talking about and the spontaneous moments kind of dissolve in the grandeur of the sound. I mean, how do you feel about that criticism?
Well, I think it's a, you know, it depends on the subject. I mean, some artists responded better than others. Some of them felt inhibited by that, and maybe some of them felt, you know, less than comfortable. But that, I wasn't one of those. I loved it for them, and I loved to be in Rainbow, and I loved to hear that. You know, I wanted to hear the sound as if I was playing in a larger room, in a concert hall. I hated, particularly as a baritone player, playing in a boxy club. I mean, it just kills that horn. It's just a dark-coloured horn in the low register. And when you're playing, you know, with playing into a, you know, into a bunch of people's coats and socks and everything, it just muffles it, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel good. So to play in Rainbow with Jan Erik's miking and everything is heaven. So, you know, for me, it never bothered me. I got a buzz from it, and I you know, so I think it suited some more than others, and perhaps those that it didn't suit dropped off. And because I mean, I know I've had this discussion with Jan Erik not long ago. He said, funny enough, if you listen now back to some of the earlier recents, they don't sound half as much reverb as, you know, as you listen to other people's today. It's a matter of, at the time, it sounded, you know, people thought that there was a great, but actually, when you listen to it now, it's actually not that much. It's not as extraordinary. So, you know, perhaps some things, for some people it worked, and for others, yes, maybe less so.
Do you think also there's and I think this goes, I think for you too, a sort of unashamed quest for beauty and framing beauty, as well as the spirit and spirituality in a much more European way than traditionally jazz has been, but very much a quest for beauty and beautiful music.
Yeah, I think I would definitely have to admit to the label of being a bit of a romantic. I mean, definitely. I like, you know, I'm a physical listener to music. I'm not at all analytical. I can be listening to someone play it, and my partner Karen will say to me, what's that chord sequence? And I'll say, well, I don't know. And then if I listen to it, I might. But it's not, I'm not actually listening tech. I just listen with the heart. You know, so sometimes there'll be music. I mean, she tends to listen to jazz radio in Norway, yes, most of which I find is kind of mediocre. It doesn't really move me. Yeah. So suddenly the dial shifts, and there's two bars of that Egyptian singer, Kulthum, and suddenly my heart will beat faster. You know, and I'll feel, because it's a quality of something's got to touch me here to make me interested in music. And it's a lot to do with the sound. It's a lot to do with the message. I'm not kind of moved a lot by technical virtuosity, yes, and, you know, skill. It's not that that gets to me. So, you know, when it comes to the music, yeah, it's getting that sound quality across.
Because I think you make some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard. And I'm wondering, you know, the consciousness you might have of that yourself in a way, or whether, you know, you call yourself a romantic, but the wherever you are and whatever kind of context I seem to sort of come across you, that one of my favourite albums of all time is the, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Themar, with Noah Barham, and you're on there with Dave Holland and John Sermon. That's one of Manfred's great sort of cross-collaterations and cross-fertilizations, putting you with an oud player. Or whether you're working with a string quartet, or whether you're embedded in Thomas Stanko, or whether you're playing with Jacques Dejonnet or Paul Blay. You know, it seems to be beauty that you're pursuing, and it's very beautiful music. And I just wondered if that was something that is important to you in a restless, sort of cynical age.
Well, I suppose it is. I'd have to say that I, you know, actually, when you're playing that, I'm just playing, yeah, the best I can. Yeah. So what comes out comes out. Yeah. You know, I don't. It's not that I would step back and say I think this is I'm going to approach it this way. This is you know, it comes from the heart, and that's it. Yeah. And so I won't, you know, I can't claim to have that much control over it that I would. I make much in the way, any judgment is a snap judgment, yes, on what, that's just the way I play.
Yes.
That's, you know, it's precisely that. But it still means a lot, the playing. I mean, if I'm playing with, which rarely happens, I'm playing with musicians who I don't feel that comfortable with, and the music isn't meaning anything, then I'm out of there quickly. It doesn't do anything for me.
When you come across, say, a new player that you might be playing with way back in times with your Jacques Dejonnet and Mike Osborne, and what comes first in terms of you realizing that you will work with them really well? Is it when you meet them socially and have a conversation with them, or is it that moment when you start to play? Is that the moment when you realize this is going to be a long term collaboration?
I don't think that. Long term, I think we never know.
You never know.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's as much to do with circumstance as it is to do with wish, really. There are several people I'd like to have worked with a lot more than I have. But, I'll think of somebody in a minute.
Okay.
Now, but I mean, offhand, I mean, but
yeah.
But certainly not. I mean, actually enjoying the company and being socially comfortable with people is definitely helpful. I mean, because you do spend an awful lot of time as a musician traveling and being in other people's company, and so some kind of social compatibility is quite helpful for a long-term relationship, I think. Yeah, but no, it's definitely in the music that, and I think that the bond is formed between the two people, and you just instinctively know that you get on, that you're interested in probing,
and you want to keep coming back for more of what it, you know, the conversation, if you like.
Over,
as you get older, you keep thinking, what's Jack thinking at the moment, and you can find out by playing with him.
Yeah, and you know, when you get back with people that you've got things in common with, or musicians who you really respect, there always seems to be something else on the horizon. There's another way of doing it. They come refreshed, as it were, bringing something new to the table. At least that's the, you know.
And if I may ask a really kind of broad, general, maybe slightly infuriating question, but I'm interested in what you think ultimately it's all for, what you've done this for, this incredible body of work that obviously will continue for many years soon, John. But I'm just interested in when you think about it and what you believe it's for, because you obviously have a standard. You're obviously after something. You obviously want the work to be constantly improving. What is the motivation for that?
I just like doing it, I think. You know, it's a kind of question that I really would love to have a great answer to. What's it for? Blimey, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? I'm not altogether sure about that one. But I think if I lose the compulsion to play, I'll stop doing it. But it's just that feeling of, you know, like, for example, tonight we're going to play a concert with the string quartet and Chris, and I'm looking forward to it. Because we had a little rehearsal last night, and some of it sounded—it's a couple of new pieces, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they turn out. It sounds like we might have just cracked another element in this. The quartet may be moving on a bit. Yes. You know, we've been getting even more integrated in this music and enjoying it more. And the smiles were there, and the pleasure was there immediately. We started to play last night, so you know, when I feel that, it's good. Yes. When I'm standing in the queue for security at the airport, I feel more reluctant to continue, you know. Yeah. And I think the one thing that would probably stop me playing is just the travelling and that sheer hassle of wondering if my saxophone will be there at the end of the day. I mean, it may sound a bit of a digression, but to be perfectly honest, it is a very vital part of this whole darn music making.
I was wondering also, I was listening to How Many Clouds Can You See today, which was 1970, I think-ish. And it was amazing that it was almost every split second, every decision you were making about the music in collaboration with the other players seemed to be setting up where you would eventually have gone. Indeed, you know, that I could see, you know, it was almost like what seems to happen is that the possibility you set up through making this kind of music, there are so many places you can go, because every single decision can open up whole new trajectories. And it seems to be that, you know, even that early work that you were doing hinted at where indeed you've gone, you know, the fascination with old music, 16th, 17th century music, fascination with, you know, English folk, fascination with jazz itself. You were hinting already, you were offering little clues about where you might go, and it's like you threw those sort of markers out and you followed them. Would that be the case?
Yeah, I'm saying, I have to go back and say that's hindsight to me. I would not have known that at that time. I'm just looking for what's, you know, looking for what's happening and finding inspiration in the people that I'm playing with and seeing where it's going. Is the pointer is it's going there simply because it's me. And I wouldn't have known, you know, in some cases I would have been, I certainly was fairly confused at that point as to what this was all leading up to. Because it wasn't leading up to being, you know, a straightforward jazz music. But then again, as we said earlier in this conversation, neither was the music wasn't standing. The music had gone rocketing from 64 when I think Train recorded Crescent to 68 when we recorded Ascension. And, you know, and Dolphy's Out to Lunch was in 64, I think, you know. And so in 3 years there was Albert Eiler. And I was in the middle of that real time. It wasn't that I was looking back on that era. By the 64, I had caught up with the state of jazz in the way that I was trying to play the music. So I went whoosh in those years, and I was out, let freedom ring. So I think for many of us, I don't think we really knew where this was going to end. And so, you know, you can look back now and see the pointers. And of course, because I've carried on, I wasn't one of those who blew up and became an icon and, you know, wonder what he would have done next. You know, I'm afraid everyone knows what I did next, you know. And sometimes that's maybe not the way to become a legendary hero, you know. I mean, everything's out to dry. That's what I've done. It's what I've done all these years. For good or for ill.
And do you ever get in the dark night of your soul the sense of why isn't this the music that has the audience, i.e. the audience is elsewhere, and at times jazz has suffered greatly from, you know, if we call it jazz, has suffered greatly from other distractions, if you like, and other people thinking that jazz was dead, etc. Do you feel sometimes, you know, a regret that you know, you make these, I'm just doing it on your behalf maybe, that you make these astonishing albums, but in a way the fashionable glancing, the glare is elsewhere, and you're a fairly lonely kind of groove that you're walking.
Yeah, but I think you realise fairly early on that this is not, you know, you're not going to be top of the pops, as it were, you know, and I'm not, you know, not even close. But so you realise you're in an area of music making that is not easily accessible to all of the public. And sometimes, yeah, it would be nice if more people kind of really understood what it was about and we got a better presentation of it. I feel even now today when I'm listening to average jazz radio stations, there's so much mediocre that's playing such great music. I listen to it's easy to just criticise the Norwegian radio over here. Nobody's going to get hurt. I say, I haven't heard them play a single Duke Ellington track. I mean, how on earth can you go, I've listened to it for 6 months now, and not play at least 10 or 15, I mean, the whole body of work, that sort of thing. And you know, copyist players are not particularly good. I mean, yeah, sure, everyone's got a right to say that, but there's a kind of ignorance about really what the great music in jazz is, and I think, and that's a shame.
And in a way, that great jazz, whatever time period it's from, it's still contemporary, really. It's still about, you know, well, a kind of imagination. And
without it, yeah. You know, the adventurous souls are doing now, and youngsters are trying to do, and there are good, really fantastic young players that are really great. I mean, I think you asked me a question back there that I failed to really answer, and I was thinking
past kind of working, that you'd never quite work with as much as you would like
to. No, it wasn't that one. It relates to the question you asked me about what did I feel about the popularity of it. And in the dark moments wondering. Mm. But, you know, from my point of view, I've always felt blessed because I've always been invited to work with these lot of so many fantastic musicians, you know, and so for me it's like a kid in a sweet shop, really. You know, I'm going to go play with Richard Galliano, a fantastic accordion. I've never actually played with him before, so, you know, oh well, that's going to be great too. Tonight I've got this, you know, so new, and that, then I've got that, and then the next day I'm going to play a solo concert, and I haven't played one solo concert in about 6 years. So, that'll be fun. I wonder what I'm going to come up with. So, you know, but it's also that thing of being able to play with the likes of, you know, Blay and all the other people that I play with, Dave and Anwar, and, you know, I have to look at records to see who it's been like, you know, and Gil. Imagine I play with Gil Evans' band, you know, and just rode on the train talking with Gil's early days. Yeah, and, you know, it's fantastic to be able to think that I've done that. I would never have dreamt when I was coming up to London to go to music college, that I would get to play with that, leave alone get to play with a choir in Salisbury Cathedral or to play in Paris Opera or to, you know, I would never have dreamt that I'd done a hundredth of the things that I've done. So, you know, I can't say that there are many, you know, dark hours of feeling regret about, you know, if people pick up on the music, that's great. And enough do to make it fun to play, and I managed to get audiences, and there are people that like to listen to the music, so that's kind of it's not a bonus, it is important. I mean, obviously one wants to communicate, particularly at this point, it'd be disaster after kind of playing jazz for 50 years, which, you know, this is, if you think when I first played the clarinet when I was 15, you know, that a few people haven't sort of enjoyed it, we would feel it was a bit of a wasted life, you know. But I mean, at least I've got the satisfaction of knowing that people have got come and say, well, you know, I really enjoyed this, or I was moved by that, or this means, or, you know, we played that track when my son was born and all this kind of stuff. It's great. It's fantastic. Yeah. And so it means something.
And finally, I was going to actually ask this at the very beginning. So in a way, this is the beginning and now indeed the end. But you talked to Sonny Rollins. I was going to sort of do a cheat, actually, because I think it's quite interesting that you interviewed Sonny Rollins, you know. So, you know, often writers, journalists talk to musicians and they have a kind of different... the thing they're after, in a way, a different story that they're looking for. So I was just interested what you would talk to Sonny Rollins about.
It was an amazing... we talked for 5.5 hours. I think we took a break or two, but we did end up... We both found out that we couldn't pass a music shop window. We just loved looking at instruments. And he told me the story of his uncle, when he was probably about 13 or 14, maybe 8 or 9 or something, had an alto saxophone pulled out from under the bed, and he loved to open it, and it had this plush red velvet line, you know, the lined case, and there's this gold instrument, you know, and me too. I was exactly the same. I just love instruments. They're so beautiful, and, you know, you pass the music store window and there's some exotic instrument there, and they're, you know, aesthetically very pleasing, you know, French horn is beautiful to look at, you know. So all those kind of things, and then sharing this experience of, you know, well, do you listen to your music much? And, well, no, not really. And so it was really fun to talk to him in that way. And I was lucky enough, a funny thing happened. It must have been in 66 or something. We were playing a late night jam at Ronnie Scott's. And the chap who was running the old place, Dougie Rouse, had been doing the door at Ronnie's. And he brought Sonny down. And I was playing with Mike Osborne, I think, Harry Miller and Alan Jackson were just rehearsing. And Sonny came with us and he jammed with us. So I've actually played with Sonny Rollins, which is a pretty astounding thing to say, you know. And he'd remembered that. So it was, you know, it was really nice. And he is one of my great, absolute idols. I even when he played at the Barbican in the London Jazz Festival last year, I mean, I was quite... Well, you can hear it now. I was very, very moved because his playing then was just so direct. There's no artifice. No, it was just, here I am. And the message was loud and clear. I'm here and, you know, I have something to say to you. And I got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy, did I get it. You know, whoa. So, you know, that's what it is. It's just a pure physical reaction. It just... Yeah. Threw me back in the sea.
Well, as that kind of interview in a way as a writer is my performance, you know, I guess I can now say that I've improvised with John's sermon, which gives me a great deal of pleasure. So thanks ever so much, John.
It's been great talking
to
you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you.